So our sutta I want to read a bit from the very front, the very first part, the opening of the sutta. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. And so right at the beginning of the sutta, pointing is to the purpose, the aim, the direction that this path takes us. And it's evocative in some visceral ways, the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, the disappearance of pain and grief. From our ordinary perspective of the way our hearts work, that description might sound cold or something. Sometimes people have said, I don't know that I want to let go of grief. Or so just a little bit of an understanding or a description or a kind of a sense of this. I think that sense that somehow, I mean, I don't know, there may be a sense that we're not human if we don't feel grief or something like that, you know, that it means we're just indifferent, kind of an indifferent quality to the mind if there's not grief in response to suffering in the world. And so what does it mean? What does that mean? That freeing from grief, that freedom from sorrow, lamentation, what is it? This pointing to nibbana. And my understanding partly is that idea that freedom from grief, freedom from sorrow, freedom from pain and despair and lamentation means indifference is because our usual perspective on the world can't fathom what it's like in that letting go, in the release that happens, around recognizing the impermanent nature of experience, the deep recognition that it doesn't make any sense to cling. Our sorrow, our pain, our grief cannot fathom any other way of responding to suffering in the world. And so it seems like it would be cold or indifferent. And yet there is, in the deep understanding and the letting go, a different kind of relationship to that suffering that is not participating with that mental disquiet, fully understanding, acknowledging the suffering, and yet not having agitation, distress in the mind about it. Now that doesn't mean that action wouldn't follow. And the Buddha spent his life acting to support beings to understand this truth. So his very life is a demonstration that that freedom itself doesn't mean non-action. And so this path heads in a direction towards something that we can't quite understand at the outset. It says in this sentence that this is the direct path. This is a translation, different ways that this word that's translated as direct path is understood. I like direct path because it kind of points to that the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness kind of heads us, slopes us in the direction of freedom. There's another analogy about the path of practice in general, the Eightfold Path, and it says, just as whatever rivers there are, all slant, slope, and incline towards the ocean, so too, one who develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path slants, slopes, and inclines towards Nibbana. This is my sense of the meaning of that direct path, or one way to understand the direct path. That when we are on this path and committed to the cultivation, the development of the establishment of wise mindfulness, it naturally leads us in the direction of freedom, much as water up in the mountains following the course of the rivers naturally heads to the ocean without having to think about it, without having to try. It's a natural direction, a natural movement. So the theme or the topic for the exploration today is Nibbana, the promise of the teaching, the promise of this text, that this path is a direct path to freedom. These four foundations are a direct path to freedom. So this word, Nibbana, the Pali word Nibbana, means literally something like cooling. This analogy of the mind being on fire with greed, aversion, and delusion, and being quenched, cooled by the release of those fires. This analogy of fire and release of fire happens in several places in the texts, equating how we're stuck to things as being as if we are on fire, clinging as if we're on fire, and the release from that being a cooling of the fire. It's primarily understood or described not as something that we get. I mean, just even that image of cooling is the release of heat. It's the release of heat. It's not so much a thing. So it's a release. And this is primarily how it's described in the suttas as release, as not as what's attained, not as something that's attained or something that we get or hold, but rather as an ending of something. Not, it's described primarily by what it's not. It's not clinging. Non-clinging. That aspect of the refrain that we've been talking about, and one abides independent, not clinging to anything in this world. Not clinging. The ending of craving is another description. The absence of greed, aversion, delusion, all defined in terms of not what it what happens, what is with freedom, but what is released. So freedom isn't something that we pick up or that we accumulate. It's what happens as we let go, perhaps. So some definitions or from the texts, I'll read some things about Nibbana that offer some definitions and what happens to us. What kind of the experience of it might, I don't even know if we can really call it an experience. This is, what I'm going to read here is four separate texts, but I liked the way they came together, so I'll just read them as one. The extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion. This indeed is called Nibbana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, one aims at one's own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, one aims neither at one's own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and experiences no mental pain and grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. And for a disciple thus freed, in whose heart dwells peace, there is nothing to be added to what has been done, and nothing remains to be done. Just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so neither forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor contacts of any kind, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is the mind, gained is deliverance. This is peace. This is exquisite. The resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. This definition of freedom as the absence of greed, aversion, delusion. I love that definition. When I first heard the word enlightenment, I was probably in my teens. And, you know, some idea, vague idea about, you know, what it meant, and had no conception of my ever, like, getting there, except if I were to do lots of drugs or something. And then even as I met the path of practice, even as I met Buddhism, when I heard the word enlightenment, I had some idea that it meant some kind of big bang, some kind of big explosion, after which everything would be great. Even the word enlightenment had that kind of quality to me. And then hearing this definition and practicing with looking at greed, aversion, and delusion in the mind, and seeing in moments greed releasing, aversion releasing, I began to think, wow, the absence of greed, aversion, delusion, that seems like something I can understand as something in this life. I can envision, I mean, it's a possibility. It's not my experience at this moment, but I can have a sense of what it might mean to live in the world. Walking around, talking to people, being engaged, cooking breakfast, and not have greed, aversion, and delusion be there. It's an inspirational idea to me, this possibility of freedom in the midst of life. I somehow also had the idea for a while that if you got enlightened, you just would be floating on a cloud somewhere, something like that. Not engaging. But this definition, absence of greed, aversion, delusion, seems fathomable in this life. And the Buddha says this in this teaching. This is visible in this life. Freedom visible in this life. So that's inspiring to me about this. And then the description of the experience. Experiences no mental pain or grief. So this is pointing to that a mind that is not shaken by pleasant, unpleasant, as this other place says. Just as a rock remains unshaken, contacts neither the desired nor the undesired cause one to waver. So there's not a wavering quality in the mind. There's a stability of mind. That to me, it's like this stability of mind allows whatever's there to just pass through without rippling, without wavering, let's say. That my sense is, at times when I've had an experience of a heart that is not constricted, that meets suffering, there is a kind of a there's an impact of that suffering and a feeling of that. It's understood as suffering when I witness or see suffering in the world, and the heart is that open, it's understood as suffering. And so there is, it's not wavering in terms of not feeling. It's not wavering in terms of not being, having the mind be losing its peace, losing its composure. And so this is a flavor of compassion, the heart that resonates in sympathy with suffering and actually wants to act as the Buddha acted to teach. And so this notion of no mental pain and grief, but understanding that we may not, our minds may not quite be able to fathom what that might be, how that might be an opening of heart and not a stepping back and a removing ourselves from experience. So the path leading towards freedom in general is described as a gradual path. There are some descriptions in the suttas of people kind of realizing freedom in a moment. And yet this usually happens after a long period of practice. And there are descriptions of people becoming awake in a variety of situations. I read one the other day, the poem of the nun who said, "I've been practicing for 25 years and I still haven't understood the teachings. I'm not lazy. I'm not proud." And then remembering, right, the practice is about being present, and she was aware washing her feet, aware watching the water, aware standing, aware walking, heading towards her room, aware sitting down on her bed, aware putting out the lamp, and the mind releasing in that moment. There are stories of people becoming freed while standing behind the Buddha, listening to a talk and fanning him as he's giving the talk. I believe that is how Shariputra was awakened. There's a story of Ananda becoming awakened as he had been trying for days to get enlightened so that he could attend an important meeting that was only open to people who were fully enlightened, and realizing at some point the teacher said balance was the way. This was after the Buddha had died. And so he decided to lie down. He sat down on his bed and he shifted his posture. His feet came off the floor. His head was heading down towards awakened in that process of shifting postures. So this points to that there can be a moment in which freedom happens, and yet all of these cases, there was some dedicated practice. Probably, and in explicitly in the case of the nun, 25 years of dedicated practice. We think that moment is important, but that moment is not going to happen without those 25 years. And so this gradual path, this is what the Satipatthana Sutta is encouraging us to engage with. This gradual path, this path of moment after moment, meeting experience. The Buddha describes in a couple of analogies the gradual nature of this awakening. I'll read these to you also. When a carpenter or a carpenter's apprentice looks at the handle of his adze, they see the impression of their fingers and thumb, but they do not know. So much of the adze handle has been worn away today, so much yesterday, so much earlier. But when it has worn away, the knowledge occurs to them that it has worn away. So too, when one dwells devoted to development, even though no such knowledge occurs to one, so much of my taints have been worn away today, so much yesterday, so much earlier. Yet when they are worn away, the knowledge occurs to them that the taints have been worn away. Suppose there was a seafaring ship bound with rigging that had been worn away in the water for 6 months. It would be hauled up on dry land during the cold season, and its rigging would be further attacked by the wind and the sun. Inundated by rain from a cloud, the rigging would easily collapse and rot away. So too, when one dwells devoted to development, one's fetters easily collapse and rot away. When we think about these analogies, the rigging, the rope being worn away by the sun, the sand, the wind, the water. Each day, if you were to look at it, you wouldn't see what's been worn away. But at some point, the rope collapses, it rots away. Then this piece too, it says, the knowledge occurs to one that it has worn away. This too is an interesting framing of understanding. There are clearly stories in the teachings where the awakening happens, and in that moment, somebody is aware in that moment, oh, that's been freed, that's been released. There's freedom now. And yet this description has resonated with me from my own experience. When it has worn away, the knowledge occurs to them that it has worn away. There may or it may not be immediate that one knows that something is released. There was a period of time when I was working with anger, a particular anger about a particular person and something that person had done. And I spent a lot of time looking at that anger, exploring it, being with it, meeting it, and then at some point recognizing that the very activity of trying to look at it, it was like I was trying to put it under a microscope. I am going to figure this out. And at some point I recognized that activity was actually catching me in the anger. And so I needed to set that aside for a while. And I used what I called the not now practice. I see you, not now, I'll be back. And I did that for quite a while with this particular anger. Each time it arose, I fully saw it and met it. And it's like I bowed to it. Each time I saw it, I bowed to it and said, okay, I see you, and not now. And at some point, I noticed a gradual change over months. It might have even been years. I don't know how long this lasted. I don't remember now. But there was a gradual change that I began noticing, like, not coming up as much anymore. I wasn't as swept away by that anger. It got weaker. I noticed it was weakening. And then one day, I had a thought about the person that I was angry at and recognized, wow, I haven't been angry in a long time about that. And I couldn't even call it up anymore. Even having the person in my mind, it's like I couldn't even remember how that particular anger was constructed or felt, and it was gone. And I knew it was gone. But I didn't know when it had disappeared. So there was a moment of seeing and understanding it was gone. But not the seeing it go. Not the seeing of the release of it. So this speaks to me in that way. This speaks to me that maybe this awakening, I mean, what I described is not nibbana. It was the release of a particular pattern. But there's some resonance with when we see certain kinds of releases in our experience, that it points us in a way to the flavor of releasing greed, aversion, delusion. And so we may get a taste of that. Taste of that, a sense of what it might be to be free. So the gradual nature of the path. To me, this is also inspiring because I've been doing this for more than 20 years now. So the fact that the Buddha said it was gradual, it's like, okay. I'm in good company. So the refrain in the Satipatthana Sutta, I think, talks a little bit about how this establishment of mindfulness, how the practice of Satipatthana takes us on this gradual path, puts us in this river heading towards the ocean. The refrain has these three pieces that Gil mentioned early in the retreat. And as he described, there's an oar between each of the three pieces. I'll just read it now and then talk about it a little bit. I'll read it with respect to the fourth foundation, since that's the one we've been doing most recently. One abides contemplating Dhamma as Dhamma, Dhamma experience. One abides contemplating experience as experience. In terms of, well, I'll do it with the five aggregates, because that's what I'm looking at. One abides contemplating Dhamma as Dhamma in terms of the five aggregates. Whoops. Sorry. In this way, one abides contemplating Dhamma as Dhamma internally, externally, and both internally and externally. One abides contemplating Dhamma in its arising, Dhamma in its ceasing, or Dhamma in its arising in ceasing. Or else, mindfulness that there is experience is established in one to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So the three pieces. One contemplates, one abides contemplating experience, whether body, feeling, mind states, internally and externally. This is, to me, this is the part of the practice, and Thanissaro Bhikkhu points to this refrain as kind of different stages or different parts of practice, and that it's a kind of a sequential development of practice. They do have oars between them, but it does seem to point to kind of a deepening understanding and deepening connection with experience in each of these sections. So the first part understands experience internally, externally, both internally and externally. The internally, my understanding of that is really our direct experience. This is a lot what we've been working on. Just meeting experience, the establishment of knowing. This is the experience that's happening. Over and over again, the teaching's pointing to this is body. This is pleasant. This is unpleasant. This is greed. This is the absence of greed. This is the first part of the practice, the establishment of recognizing, being aware in the present moment, understanding our experience directly. The externally part, the commentaries say that it refers to understanding the foundations in reference to the other beings. And so understanding, like my looking out at the room, that there are bodies. There are feelings. I may or may not know exactly what's happening, but there are times, and we can recognize at times through seeing how somebody's standing or walking, there can be a sense of what their mind is, what they're experiencing to some extent. We have to understand that that's a, it's an idea, not necessarily what's actually happening. But the suttas or the teachings seem to be pointing us to recognizing, we recognize, yes, this is a process. So we look, we recognize, yep, these are five aggregates here. Body, mind, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, flow of process. And that we're also asked to remember flow of process in all beings. And I think this points to helping us recognize essentially the impersonal nature of what's going on in here. It's like, yeah, this here is happening there too. It cultivates a sense of both the right, I'm not alone, and compassion for, you know, I remember at one point on a retreat, I was walking and recognizing some kind of dukkha in my own experience around my life, my history, and something, and recognizing in that moment the mind also understood, oh my gosh, this is like multiplied by 6 billion people. Oh, no wonder there's so much suffering in the world. No wonder it's so painful. No wonder it's so hard to get along. And so something about understanding the external there was opening here, opening to this heart. And so this is a piece of the gradual path, a piece of the understanding that comes as we establish just this bare recognition of this is the body process, these are the feelings, these are the perceptions, in here, out there, this is what's happening. There's a kind of a recognition of the impersonal nature of experience. And so this is a piece of the insight, a piece of the path, a piece of the understanding that leads towards freedom. So that's a step in that direction. And the second piece, understanding impermanence. Here the language is interesting. It says one understands it's not just arising and passing of experience. It's the language isn't simply like that. In the sutta or in the section on the aggregates, it is that simple. When I read that piece or explored that piece with you on the aggregates, the impermanence around the aggregates, it said something like one understands feeling, one understand feeling arising, one understands this is the arising of feeling, one understands this is the ending of feeling. So understanding something about the impermanence of the feeling, the perception, the body itself. So that's beginning to point us to the impermanence of the experience itself. In the refrain, it uses the language one understands the nature of arising, the nature of passing, the nature of arising and passing. And this, I don't know exactly what this means, and it's translated in a variety of ways, actually. And you get different interpretations with the varieties. But I asked myself, what is this? How does this resonate with my experience? And what I understood as I explored that is that, like, in looking at seeing, like with the five aggregates, seeing feeling arising and passing, there's something that's understood about feeling itself there. But what my sense of this is that we're being asked in this part of the refrain to understand the nature of arising and passing. What is, be attuned to recognizing impermanence itself, not the thing that's impermanent, or the experience. I shouldn't say thing, because things don't, they're not things, they're processes. But attuning to the impermanence itself. And this is some of what I pointed to in the guided meditation yesterday, noticing how impermanence is experienced. I don't know if this is what attuning to the nature of impermanence, nature of arising, nature of passing means in this text, but it was meaningful to me. And this is definitely a practice that I found useful as I attuned to how is impermanence known, more interested in the impermanent, how impermanence is experienced, than in what is impermanent itself. And so maybe this is partly what this is pointing to, the cultivation of an insight around impermanence itself. With the deep recognition of impermanence, the deep understanding of impermanence, there is when we see that just the impermanent nature of things arise, pass, arise and pass, there's a deep understanding that clinging is futile. And to some extent, a recognition with the depth of impermanence that we meet, that there actually isn't anything to cling to. It's all vanishing, even as it comes into existence. And so we also see in that understanding the suffering of the clinging and the recognition of the unhelpful, futile nature of clinging. The mind seeing that simply begins to let go, because the mind understands there's nothing to cling to and that any attempt will create suffering. And then the last part of the refrain: mindfulness is established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. To me, this points to the establishment of mindfulness and the pointing that Gil offered this morning in the guided meditation, not trying to be mindful, not trying to pay attention to anything, simply knowing. That establishment of mindfulness, that continuity establishment of mindfulness, allows the understanding of impermanence to release the mind to not clinging. And so this refrain, I feel, points to how we walk the gradual path with Satipatthana. And so we experience little tastes of release from time to time. I pointed to one a few moments ago where I recognized that something had gone, had disappeared. There are different ways, so many different ways we experience insight, understanding, the insights, the understandings may be framed in terms of understanding impermanence, but also the understanding of impermanence has a couple of other flavors at times. It's like sometimes the flavor of understanding impermanence is that, oh, it would be suffering to cling to that. It's unreliable. Experience is unreliable. So a kind of a sense of the dukkha nature of experience. Sometimes our insights come that way. And we see a release from that dukkha. Maybe an example of this is recognizing, you know, in a moment we might recognize the arising of some kind of reactive experience and feel the struggle of that, feel the suffering of that. And then in through the mindfulness, recognize, oh, that's dukkha. That understanding for me has created, it's not necessarily that the dukkha goes away in that moment, but there's like a space around it. It's like, oh, right, this is dukkha. This is what the Buddha pointed to for us to understand. And so there's a shift of perspective around dukkha as we see it as dukkha, not as me or mine or my dukkha, but as the just, this is what was asked to be understood. This is asking to be understood. And so there, that shift or that recognition, oh, this is dukkha. Whew. Sometimes we feel a bigger container in which we know that reactivity and yet experience at the same time a kind of ease in the mind, maybe even a joy in the mind. This is a flavor of insight around understanding dukkha and seeing the possibility for a little bit of release with that dukkha, not being so caught in the middle of it. We experience a little bit of release with that. Or we may, at some point through the seeing of our experience in a kind of moment-by-moment way, see a thought arise in the mind, and that conditions a desire. We see a thought of a piece of bread with Swiss cheese on it while we're doing walking meditation. Pops into our mind. There it is. And that thought in the mind conditions, and maybe that thought was conditioned by hunger. Maybe we didn't see that. But we saw the thought, and then we see a kind of a desire formed for that thing. And maybe we see then out of that desire a plan form, and then maybe an activity of walking towards the refrigerator until we actually write, oh, wait, walking meditation. So we can start to see, and we can understand that as conditioned, not as sometimes seeing that kind of pattern arising in the mind, we recognize, I didn't like decide to think that thought. I didn't even make the plan to go to the refrigerator. It just happened. And so we witness this process nature of our experience, the conditioned nature of our experience. Not me, not mine. Sometimes it can just feel like, you know, who's doing this stuff anyway? It's just happening. Again, this is a flavor of insight. And there's often in these recognitions a feeling of release of in that understanding. And that release is a pointing to freedom. A pointing to freedom when there's that little shift and the heart isn't quite so caught. Whew, there's a release. There's a recognition of not me doing this. There can be a release. So there's so many different ways we see little releases, little flashes of insight, understanding. These moments when there's a shift, a recognition of understanding, they're kind of a pointer for us, a pointer to something like freedom. It's not full freedom, because there's still delusion at work in our minds, but there maybe is the flavor, a little bit of the flavor of some release. We might notice a particular kind, like I noticed a particular kind of aversion, a particular kind of anger, that specific anger about that particular person and that particular event. That anger is gone. Aversion still comes up. But there's an understanding of the possibility of that freedom, that it's like there's a kind of the way the mind can extrapolate from that and have a sense of the possibility of freedom in these little moments. And so these moments are kind of a pointer. And so, like, really almost like take in that, that experience, that insight, that understanding, not with thinking about it, but with the recognition of the release that happens with it. My understanding, this too, just from my own understanding, you know, we talk about the establishment of mindfulness and the continuity of mindfulness being the place where insights can arise. And my own practice or exploration around this was, I first thought when I heard this establishment of mindfulness, it's like, okay, I really need to chug, work hard for many days, and then maybe I'll get some mindfulness established, and maybe it'll get there. I'll have some mindfulness for maybe a half an hour, and then maybe I'll have an insight. But what I've seen happening, actually, is that there can be these little, like, just conditions that come together in a moment while you're in the kitchen cutting an apple. And the conditions have come together for mindfulness to be established for a second. And in that moment of cutting the apple, the mind understands something very deeply. Understands how a thought was going to lead to a reactive pattern, and the mind letting go of it instantly, just in a second, not even trying to be mindful, but just landing in mindfulness for a moment, and in that moment, in that second, the seeing that's possible in daily life. This experience happened for me in daily life. I hadn't even been on retreat. I'd never sat a retreat. And this moment of mindfulness allowed a deep, clear seeing that had a huge impact on my life, changed the course of my life. And so we need to be available for those moments. But it's not actually necessary to, like, create a long stretch of mindfulness before insight can happen. These insights that happen are impermanent. Most of our insights that happen as we're these kind of recognitions that we have, the freedom from a pattern, or much of the time, I mean, occasionally, like that one I described, that one went away and it's never come back, and the intervening has been like 15 years, something like that. That one has never come back. But much of the time we have an insight, and it's just a conditions coming together to let us see something in that moment very deeply. And conditions are favorable in that moment to see something clearly. And then 2 minutes later, the conditions are not favorable to see that clearly anymore. And we just keep working. We keep going. We just keep walking the path. Simplicity of the path. Our work is not to do the insights. We can't do that. Our work is so simple. This radical simplicity of just knowing. That is what creates the conditions for insight. In terms of full liberation, full freedom, I mean, I said with these little short, like, second moments of established mindfulness, there can be a moment of just really clear seeing. But the end of the Satipatthana Sutta, there's a kind of an assurance given to us around where this path leads and what happens around it. This is for full liberation, is my understanding, full freedom, complete release from suffering. It says something like, if one should develop these four foundations in such a way for 7 years, one can expect full awakening. Or, it says, or if there's a little bit of clinging yet, it'll be a slightly less, there'll still be a little bit of clinging, you know, but pretty good, really good, in fact. And then it goes on to say, but let it go alone for 7 years. If you practice this for 6 years, for 5 years, for 4 years, for 1 year, in this, and my sense is what it's saying here is with this kind of establishment of mindfulness, not just kind of on and off for 7 years, but, you know, establishing mindfulness. For 1 year, he says, you can expect freedom. He goes, let alone 1 year, 7 months. 6 months, 5 months, let alone 7 months, 7 days. And that's where he stops. So, continuity of mindfulness for 7 days. It's a high bar in my mind, watching my own mind. It's a high bar, but might be doable. Maybe doable, you know? And yet, you know, we just keep walking the path. We just keep practicing mindfulness as best we can. And understanding the impersonal nature of experience, the human nature of our experience, recognizing the impersonal nature of others' experience, internally and externally, recognizing the nature of impermanence. Establishing mindfulness just to the bare extent necessary for knowledge. And one abides, not clinging to anything in this world.